If riding in a car seems too limiting and airplanes make you sick, roads in your area aren't conducive to bicycles or snow prevents it, and dogs, feed, and snow machines also don't meet your transportation needs, you might consider ballooning. Why ballooning? According to balloon enthusiast Stan Zielinski, a Fairbanks potter and professor of ceramics at the university, there is literally no better way to fly.
Why ballooning? Well, why not ballooning in a sense? It's really, I think, one of the most beautiful ways to fly, if you prefer to fly or like to fly. So I feel that this is probably the most interesting way to go.
Stan Zielinski got into ballooning via parachuting. A balloonist was needed to promote A-67, a year-long celebration of Alaska's centennial held at Alaskaland in Fairbanks. As a former skydiver, he was, quote, comfortable under fabric, and got the job that started his interest in balloons. There are several balloonists in Fairbanks with their own rigs, and the outfits cost upwards of $10,000 for a balloon, basket for crew, and equipment. Unlike bicycles and snow machines, but like other forms of air travel, ballooning is a year-round endeavor. Even when the snow is deep and temperatures well below zero, it's still possible to go up, up, and away, if you're willing to cope with the potential problems, though Zielinski would rather not.
When it really gets cold, really cold, you know, 40, 50 below, there are a lot of technical problems and just comfort problems, and I don't particularly care to fly when it gets super cold. I've tried it a couple of times, but it's just too much work, and I don't think it's as safe as it could be when it's really cold. So for a variety of reasons, I just consider it a fair weather sport.
It's not only weather that can cause complications. Electrical wires and lack of roads for getting picked up when the ride is over are also factors to consider.
I have been stranded for upwards to 2 days in various situations, but you're never really in serious trouble, short of landing in water or something of that nature, or wires. But to be down in a remote area is a matter of inconvenience, really, rather than severe danger.
Zielinski is no stranger to being stranded. Several times he's slogged his way out of unscheduled and secluded landing spots, coming back later to pack out the gear or pack in more propane to fly back out, and he's been rescued by helicopters and riverboats. It's something that's happened to many pilots of more conventional aircraft as well.
People up here are quite interested in becoming private pilots, and there are a lot of personal airplanes. Do you think the same attraction could be applied to ballooning, at least eventually?
To a certain extent, yeah, but it's an entirely different kind of flying. The fixed-wing pilot, I sort of would liken him to a bulldozer operator, really, as he plows through the air anywhere he wants to go. With a balloon, it's not that way. The wind will tell you where you're going to go. It dictates entirely the path of the flight. So you have to resign yourself to that. I don't feel it's a detriment, though. That's part of the interest, as far as I'm concerned, because you can't file a flight plan. You can't even tell your ground crew where you're going to go. And you don't know where you're going to go right up until the moment you land. It's a thing that you're playing with. It's a three-dimensional problem that is constant. There are variables that are affecting the nature of this flight every second of the flight, because what was so a few minutes ago won't be so the next few minutes. Mm-hmm. So that kind of problem is of a great deal of interest to me. And as I say, a fixed-wing pilot knows precisely where he's going to go before he takes off. And if that sort of thing is, you know, your nature, better stick to fixed-wing flight, because ballooning is not that way.
For Zielinski, ballooning is a kind of movement meditation.
How does it feel to be up in a balloon?
You know, I feel completely relaxed, and there's always a certain amount of anticipation regarding the landing. You know, that's always in the back of your mind, but during the course of the flight, there's a great deal of freedom and just relaxation. I feel completely relaxed. I don't care what the problems of the day were. If I'm up in a balloon, you know, that sort of solves all the hassles that you have to tolerate during the, you know, normal course of living.
Zielinski's feel for flying extends to trying to interest others in ballooning. Although he likes to take passengers up for rides, he's also interested in promoting the sport and teaching others about a sport that began in France nearly two centuries ago after two brothers discovered that they could float bags filled with hot air over their kitchen fire.
Now you read whatever's happening with the mouth of the canopy, and you have to keep from burning it. And really, this I consider most of the trouble in learning to fly, because you you'll screw up if you burn a balloon. You know, you're shot down, and you just have to be careful and get the on-off part of that and keep it aimed right.
Besides the balloon and assorted equipment, a balloonist traditionally flies off into the sunset, or whatever, with turkey sandwiches and champagne. Even with the fabric, the basket, the propane, the burners, and the movable feast, a balloonist must also have a good sense of direction and, believe it or not, a pilot's license. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Pointing out that Alaska has more land per capita than anywhere in the world except Cambodia, Senator Ted Stevens promoted the passage of an Alaska lands bill this year during a press conference this morning in Fairbanks, but not H.R. 39. Said he, quote, "We can't get a bill that's better than S-9 or worse than H.R. 39," and continued, quote, "I think if we get H.R. 39, we've lost the whole shooting match." Stating that Fairbanks is the capital of non-federally owned land in Alaska, he said there is greater opportunity here to develop private enterprise than anywhere else in the state, and stressed the need to attract independent oil and gas development by providing incentives. Quote, "You've got the future economy of the state in the palm of your hand," said Stevens, stating that he, quote, "remained committed to the concept that we ought to have a petrochemical complex here and that the heavy liquids from the gas pipeline ought to come out in Fairbanks." The senator said that once the gas pipeline was in place, quote, "there's no reason you should not become a Tulsa or a Houston as far as the oil and gas industry is concerned." That's the picture verbally painted by Senator Stevens this morning. A state compared with Cambodia for land per capita, and a city compared to Houston and Tulsa for oil and gas activity. So if Cambodia, Houston, or Tulsa strike you as appealing places to visit or live, and you're already living in Fairbanks, why travel? Just wait for the passage of an Alaska lands bill and the construction of the gas pipeline. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Looking for information on Ukrainian egg decorating, the archaeology of ancient China, the Lancashire County Amish, or gold pan painting but don't know where to turn? Grace Moore at the Fairbanks Public Library is compiling a community information service, dubbed the Data Cache, as a way to access that information. Questionnaires are used to collect data on people and organizations. Although initially one form was used for everyone, now the questionnaires are more specialized.
We have one for the visual performing artist. We have another for the sports people. We have another for the hobbyist, for the self-taught person. Another for the old-time Alaskans, or those who have Alaskan experiences that they're willing to share, or those who know Alaskan history. And we have another for people with language ability, and still another for people who have travel experiences which they're willing to share.
Would someone have to fill out all those different forms if they fell into all of those categories?
Unfortunately, I'd say yes.
You think that might discourage some people from filling out forms?
Well, judging from some of the results that we had at the fair, I think not. In fact, after a while, it got to be a sort of a game. I feel that the response has been good, and responses keep coming in.
The files will be kept open for submissions and will be updated periodically. People and organizations are encouraged to stop by the library to fill in the variously colored pages. Though the project started just this past August in Fairbanks, in other communities, similar programs have been around for some time.
Other libraries have been doing this for at least 10 years, some possibly 12 years. And the Dallas Public Library came up with 6,000 entries. The community has given them a first-class response, and in fact they've gone into such detail as to tell where one could find a plant sitter, where one could find a dog psychiatrist.
Services that may or may not be available in Fairbanks.
Right. Information that may not be necessary, too.
But you never know.
You never know. That's right. And this is what's interesting. And so many new services, people with different skills keep turning up.
The green travel form and the blue one for talent, skills, know-how are the questionnaires most often filled out. Moore says the travel experiences of Fairbanks residents are unbelievable. The talent page asks for specific areas of expertise, training and courses, experience, awards, prizes, publications, teaching experience, availability, material and time fees, and any accompanying materials. Moore does not screen the submissions regarding the quality of the purported talent, says she.
Well, now, that will be for the for the person who wants to use this person's talent to design, I think. We're an unbiased type organization. And as it is, we're going to have the information available, and people from clubs and organizations will, of course, I think, be finding a great wealth of material for their speakers, for their programs. The usefulness of the questionnaire as an instrument is that if you wanted to find out about a person's availability, a person's requirement of a fee, a person's background, and so on, you could look at the form and get a very good idea.
Newcomers to the city will also find the data cache beneficial.
But a newcomer to Fairbanks could look at the clubs and organizations form and find out, you know, what is available. Mm-hmm. And newcomers do tell me that one of the first places they come in a community is the library. So we shall be able to give them a good survey of Fairbanks and what it has to offer.
Grace Moore herself is also finding out more about the community.
I have a much greater feeling for the community of Fairbanks, and I'm much more aware of what's going on. It's really been great.
That's the Data Cache, a community information service of the Fairbanks North Star Borough Public Library. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Under H.R. 39, the Arctic Wildlife Range is designated as a national wilderness area with oil and gas assessment work prohibited. But the S-9 Alaska Lands Bill, favored by the Governor's Task Force on Alaska's Lands, creates a two-year study process to examine the wildlife implications of seismic exploration in the Arctic Wildlife Range. Based upon that study, there would be a designation of areas open to seismic exploration, and then a further three-year seismic study of that area to determine the presence of oil and gas. If there is, there would be a subsequent congressional determination necessary before development in the area could occur.
There's no question if they do find something significant that Congress will allow it to happen.
That's the opinion of Bob Whedon, professor of resource management at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, and a member of the Blue Ribbon Committee on D2, the Task Force on Alaska Lands, that met with government officials in Washington recently. Whedon feels that opening the Arctic Wildlife Range to oil and gas development is unnecessary, and he feels uncomfortable with that provision of S-9.
We really can afford, still, to keep the Arctic Wildlife Range as a whole off limits to oil and gas development. I don't think that any amount of oil and gas that's likely to be under that area is really all that critical for Alaska or for the nation. I guess I still am very perturbed when I drive in a taxi from Dulles Airport to downtown Washington. We drive 75 to 80 miles an hour, and when you look at the cars that you pass, you can't find more than 1 in 15 that has anybody except the driver in it. You know, there's no energy shortage. And I feel, like a lot of conservationists, that the most effective immediate source of relief from the Arab blackmail is conservation. You can't get relief by opening up the Arctic Wildlife Range, because even if there's anything there, it'll take 5 years to find it and 10 years to get it out. That's not immediate relief. So my feeling is that we can afford to leave the oil, if there is any, in the Arctic Wildlife Range for a very long time.
Bob Whedon, one of 15 members of the Blue Ribbon Task Force on Alaska Lands. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Although the 15 members of the Governor's Blue Ribbon Task Force and D2 represented a variety of interests, ranging from strong advocacy of resource development to conservation-oriented preferences to limit land exploration and exploitation, all but two voted to seek passage of S-9, the bill reported out of the Energy Committee. The two opposition votes were cast by men. There was only one woman member of the panel who felt that H.R. 39 was intolerable and S-9 wasn't acceptable either. They were Harold Gillum, former mayor of the city of Fairbanks, and Tom Fink of Anchorage, a former state representative. Initially, former governor and secretary of the interior Walter Hickel also had a no bill is better than either of these bills attitude, but changed his opinion during the course of the meetings. According to committee member Bob Whedon of Fairbanks, a meeting with Interior Secretary Andrus was crucial in the committee's ultimate 13-2 decision to back S-9.
The consequence of no bill was clearly stated by Andrus when he said, I will withdraw 59 million acres additional beyond the 56 already. That will give you 115 million acres of monuments. And, you know, I don't really want to do it. I'd rather have congressional action, but believe me, I'm going to do it. So that laid a consequence then of no bill. And it was that single meeting, I think, with Andrus that really sharpened the committee onto the real nub of the question that we, you know, were facing. So S9, it became not a question of how we understood or liked any specific section. It was S9 generically. Was it achievable in the later political process? And if we could achieve S9, was it going to be acceptable to state interests?
Personal preferences were largely bent, says Whedon, toward the consensus that without a bill there could be no development, and with a bill, such as S9, development could occur. As a past president of the Alaska Conservation Society, Whedon is cautious regarding the need to develop land use and resource strategies in harmony. In keeping with that philosophy, he also advocates keeping roads and access to a minimum. S9 does not adhere to that attitude.
S9 makes it easier in Alaska than anywhere else in the country to get roads, utility lines, power lines, etc., pipelines through parks and refuges. And I don't really think it should be easier in Alaska than anywhere else. I think that in the process of developing S9 and HR 39, the basic attempt was to change the boundaries of the areas so that utility corridors were there by default. You know, they weren't included. And I guess my feeling is that the pressure for this easy access provision is coming from the age-old Alaskan assumption that roads bring progress. And it's kind of a symbolic thing rather than a real hard-nosed economic assessment that if we don't get X, Y, and Z corridors, we're going to forfeit this much economic development. Nobody can point that out. The only cases, in fact, where there is some reasonable economic resource to be utilized through the building of a road, those areas like the Anaconda and Kennecott properties out near Bornite, those have been relieved through the redrawing of the boundaries. They can build their roads, you know. So I feel that there is less of a real problem than there is an imagined problem based on long-standing approaches in Alaska to roads.
Whedon is not opposed to economic development, but feels that development of natural resources need not preclude allowing some lands to specifically have a wilderness designation. He feels that there could be designations of areas within wilderness areas that are acceptable for development, such as timber, oil and gas, and mining. According to Whedon, determining just what is a wilderness area is a political matter anyway.
Do we wish to have wilderness in this area? Gaining the wilderness assets forever, but foregoing certain economic possibilities. And once that judgment is made, then I think we should manage the wilderness honestly as a wilderness and not try to encroach on it by, you know, mm-hmm. wedging in unusual developments that aren't tolerated in wilderness everywhere else.
Yeah, under S9, it's kind of an enormous land deal
mm-hmm.
in which in one act, statehood and land claims and everything is supposed to be resolved in terms of conveyance of lands. Is this possible to do in one act?
I think it is. It's a wheelbarrow with a very big load, I admit, and I suppose we might hit a rock and lose the whole load. But it's interesting that the native amendments, which are rather complicated and very important, and the state land conveyance provisions are no longer really controversial in Washington. They have appeared in all of the important bills in fairly similar form. So those really aren't in jeopardy anymore, I feel. And I think that's probably the feelings of John Katz and the lawyers who lobby for the state in Washington. The controversial provisions now deal with Southeast Alaska timber, the borax mine, the Arctic wildlife range, that kind of thing.
There are, of course, many controversies to come in Congress before the Alaska Lands Bill becomes reality, whenever and in whatever form that occurs. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. Brian Rogers of Fairbanks and George Homan of Bethel co-chair the Legislative Interim Committee on the Constitutional Convention. The committee is looking into a number of different areas that relate to holding another constitutional convention. The first constitutional convention in Alaska, held in 1955, produced the state's constitution. In that document, there is a provision that every 10 years, the question of holding another such convention will appear on the ballot again. The main reason for the formation of the legislative subcommittee is to look at preparations for the next ballot question. But there's a catch as to just when that might be. Here's Brian Rogers.
One of the first questions is it going to be in 1980 or 1982? In 1970, the people voted yes, but it went to court and they decided we better have a second time. And so in 1972, the people voted no. So there wasn't a convention in the 70s. One of the questions is, will the next one be in 1980 or 1982? Most legal opinion is that it would be in 1982, but we're spending a little bit of time researching that question. It does have ramifications on the apportionment of the convention. The committee then divided up, and we're doing several major things. First of all, we're researching what's happened in other states that have had constitutional conventions, and we're paying particular attention to Hawaii's, which is one of the most recent conventions, and they've put out, and it's been approved by the voters, one of the most progressive constitutions next to Alaska in the country. We're also looking at all of the amendments that have been proposed in Alaska since statehood and sort of analyzing what have been the ones that have come up again and again, what seem to be the major issues. Length of session is one. I know judges and election of judges and attorney generals. There are several like that have come up several times and haven't gone before the voters. Others, for example, the permanent fund was discussed for a while and then did go to the voters and became an amendment to our Constitution. Then one thing we're doing, which I'm very excited by, is we're translating the Constitution into Yupik. I believe it's going to be the first translation of a Constitution into a native language. We chose Yupik first because it has the most number of people speaking Yupik. And
Senator Homan is on your committee.
Obviously, that has an impact. His area is Yupik speaking. But in talking with the people here at the Native Languages Center, it's the logical choice. Many documents, they try out in Yupik first, and if it works in Yupik, then they'll try in Inupiaq or Athabaskan or whatever. But Yupik is an easy language to translate in, apparently, and is a good model.
At the reconvening in 76 of the original delegates from the first constitutional convention, were there any suggestions that were derived from that that may be applied?
Yes, very much so. We are transcribing the tapes from the workshops where some of the ideas came out. There were no formal recommendations, but some of the workshops found some real problems. Local government is one area that probably needs some more work. There was fairly lively discussion at the legislative workshop on whether we should have a unicameral or a bicameral legislature. As you know, the voters in an advisory vote 3 years ago said, yes, we should have unicameral. The legislature has not yet acted upon that and perhaps has an inherent conflict of interest on that kind of a thing. Perhaps amendments concerning the legislature or legislative-executive relationships are such that really they only can be dealt by a constitutional convention.
If a convention is called, whether by vote of the people or by a vote of the legislature, what happens next?
The statutes are silent on it so far. Apparently an oversight of all the legislatures so far. The Constitution says that if a convention is called, the call for the convention shall conform as nearly as possible to the 1955 call. What that did was to say that there would be one delegate for each representative's district, one for each senator's district, and one for each of the five statewide officers, the congressional delegation and the governor and lieutenant governor, which would mean today we'd have 65 delegates. But there is a question, depending on whether we have a convention, say, in 1981 or 83, we'd have two different apportionment plans. And the question is, would it be subject to judicial review? What would the courts rule if it went to the courts? And we do have legal staff researching the area of convention apportionment right now. It obviously makes a big difference in terms that the 1982 reapportionment of Alaska will substantially change the balance of power in the legislature, and thus would in the convention as well.
In all probability, after the 1982 reapportionment, Anchorage would have an absolute majority as opposed to a near majority. Though Rogers says it's hard to tell just what the effect would be, he mentions the concerns of rural areas as one aspect of potential impact. Preservation of the rural lifestyle, for example, which may be of less concern to urban representatives. Reapportionment or not, there are quite a number of issues that are likely to be brought up at a constitutional convention, including local government, the election of judges and attorney generals, the length of the legislative session, the permanent fund, lands, and a unicameral legislature.
I'm a little concerned, though, that something that often happens in conventions and in state constitutions is that we try to legislate by constitution, and I believe very strongly that the constitution is sort of the broad outline, and you give the legislature and the people a fair amount of flexibility in what laws you make. Alaska was very progressive in passing a constitution that was a framework rather than being highly detailed, and other states are fighting to get rid of little minute details in their constitutions. And I'm a little nervous that people who have specific statutory interests and have been unsuccessful at getting those written into law may try to get them written into the constitution.
One area of concern to many Alaskans, including Representative Rogers, is the relationship of the state to the federal government.
Was Alaska admitted on equal footing? Have we been treated as other states have? And I would expect some of the issues revolving around the federal-state relationship would come out in a convention.
The people at the first constitutional convention really felt like pioneers, because they anticipated statehood by saying, we have a convention, we're ready for statehood. That was one of the pitches. Do you think there'd be that same intensity at a constitutional convention in the 80s?
Probably not, though, in fact, one of the fears that is most often expressed is the idea of a runaway convention, people getting bogged down in detail again, or certain things that people don't want to see in a convention. But what's happened, we found in other states, is people have risen to meet the occasion, and the delegates have looked at the greater good of the states, and we've gotten some pretty good things out of conventions.
It remains to be seen what will be gotten out of the next Alaskan Constitutional Convention, if there is one, and whenever that may be. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.